Well, good turnout. And your name in the back?
Carol.
Hi, Carol. Ken. And Tim, nice to meet you as well. And Ruth, we met before. Nice to see you, Ruth. And Mark in the back. Nice to see you, Mark. And then Robert. Bob. Nice to see you again. Yeah, nice to see you. Okay, great. So, I think I've said hello to everybody. I'm going to pass out a few things. Because we're going to work from some papers just as kind of a touchstone for the ideas of the Genuine Progress Indicator. But I want to thank everyone for coming out. I'm going to talk today about the the idea of democracy itself, at least once established in the sense of a constitutional democratic republic that we are identified with in the world, even though there's corruption and all sorts of imbalances that are associated with the achieving a more ideal democracy. I consider democracy a work in progress at this point, wanted to identify a couple of things. First is that the Ecology Democracy Network is what I'm the director of. And I'm going to pass out some basic handouts here. You can just pass them around here. I'll just give you a few. Pass them around. And and I'll go over quickly what the Ecology Democracy Network is about. Ecology Democracy Network is a nonpartisan effort. And we are focused on structural change in the economy, the way we vote, and who influences our government. The economy we want to establish is an ecology-based economy. So when habitats are healthy, economy's healthy. Very basic. Second, we want to decentralize political power by way of the vote. Go to proportional voting. So 10% of the vote for your party gets you 10% of the seats in the legislature. And then third, we want to remove big money and corporate interference in our government. So we, flesh and blood people, are the ones making decisions and not these economic tools that were invented to serve us, such as corporations. And we have strategies, tactics to achieve outcomes. Hi, welcome. I'm Ken. And
Marcia.
You are?
Marcia.
Hi, Marcia. Nice to meet you. Here's a basic handout, Marcia.
Thank you.
The basic efforts of the network are to mobilize from the grassroots to outcomes. So it's not just about an information loop. It's about actually achieving outcomes towards the objectives. Hello. Hi. Welcome. Nancy, did I get you a flyer?
No.
Here, let me get you a flyer there, Nancy.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for coming out. I'm going to pass this around. Take one. Each of you can take one. There's a couple pieces here. Nancy, can I just give you that? Just take one of those. And Bob, you can take one and pass them around. And these are what I'm going to use as kind of talking points from these handouts. So what we're going to get inside of today is the, even though, okay, corporations have undue imbalance in our democracy, we know that. That's a big discussion at this conference. The corporation has superseded not only humans, but now nation states in many respects. They've created a great imbalance in that respect. That's undermining our ability to have a reflection of we the people through our government. So that is an imbalance. We won't be talking about that, but that's part of our effort. The other imbalance is the idea of the way we vote. Many people will participate in the voting system, in winner-take-all voting systems, and their votes will not be applied. So we'll get, 46% of the people who voted in the last Minnesota House election their votes were not weighted or applied. And so, because it's winner take all, you know, so whoever won that district won the whole thing. And so it's not reflecting in an accurate way the values of the culture through the electoral process. But the imbalance I would like to talk about, and I'm, as you can see, I'm predicating the idea that democracy works based upon more balance in society, okay? So that's kind of my main word, balance. And you'll see in the handouts that I sent around, that's part of the discussion. And do you have that, Mark? There we go. Thank you. Here we go. I'll pass it out. Yeah, make sure. Who just came in? And your name is? Hi, Jake. Here, Jake, I'm going to give you a few items here real quick.
Nancy.
So the discussion today is going to be in the economy. So the participation in our political system, that is a vital discussion we won't have time for today. But the economy, an ecology-based economy, the reason I focus on ecology first is because the premise of a lot of the thinking that I work under is the idea that we need to move from a human-centered to an ecological-centered point of view of the world as the position of strength on Earth right now. Okay, and the reason I say that is because we are a subsystem in a larger biosphere. And what we do to the larger biosphere affects all subsystems. And so if we don't take care of the larger biosphere, then we, as biological beings, are at risk, if that's about us. But for me, it's about the whole of the condition. And we have seen the last 100 years, and generally I focus on generally the last 100 years, we've seen this ascendancy from, you know, approximately 2 billion people on Earth to now closing in on 8 billion rapidly. We've seen invention, consumption rates have grown faster than population the last 80 years, and extinction rates have been growing at a similar rate the last 80 years. So as we ascend, the host is being decimated. And the thing that we focus on are three basic elements within the economy that need to be rectified. One is the idea of a growth economic model. The Ecology Democracy Network wants to end the idea of growth as the objective of the economy. And this is not only needed in the U.S., but endemic around the world in general. But generally, the growth patterns and the growth ascendancy in about 13 or 14 nation states are the most problematic on the planet right now. And generally, that includes the U.S. and Australia and some European countries and Brazil and China and Russia. We want to go to a degrowth and then a steady state economy, generally articulated by Herman Daly. I'm still learning how to understand the language of Herman Daly, but generally he's kind of one of my inspirations. And he wrote a book called Steady State Economics. Herman Daly, and it's D-A-L-Y. And he wrote also, he used to work with the World Bank. He came out of the World Bank and he wrote books like Ecological Economics. He wrote For the Common Good with Cobb. And then he wrote Steady State Economics. And those have been guiding principles of modern day ecological economics. And it's also, he helped devise the precursor to the Genuine Progress Indicator. And he's been working on refining that. The other elements are the two drivers that we focus on that are driving overshoot on the Earth. Now, right now, we need 1.6 planets every year to exist on Earth. So we are using more than the Earth can replenish at this point. So we're more than 50% beyond the ability of natural systems on the planet to restore themselves as we speak. And that is accelerating. And so we're trying to reverse that. And there are two key elements to that we need to focus on that I think we need to reverse that. One, we want to end the idea of using the gross domestic product as a primary economic signal on Earth. And generally, it is the primary gatekeeper in most every economy on the planet. Not absolute, but generally. The other thing is we want to end the idea of interest-bearing debt, or the idea of usury, which is historically as identified as a driver. We won't be able to get into that. There are a number of people at this gathering who are talking about the monetary issues, which I think is critical. And I'm not being any particular. There's a variety of options. I'm not complaining about which ones get adopted at this point, just as long as they no longer keep rewarding interest on debt on the planet.
I've been to one, and I'm finding that very interesting. I know this is not dear to that. This is new to me. Can you say in a sentence or two how? This is new to me.
Well, basically, in a nutshell, just in the modern era, and I don't claim to be a monetary theorist or expert, but the gist is in 1913, the United States passed the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve Act basically privatized the printing of our money. So when the United States borrows money, they borrow from private banks who tag interest on basically our public money. And once they tag interest on money we borrow from these banks, then we have to borrow more money to pay the interest on that. Then we have to borrow more money to pay the interest on the interest. We have to borrow more money to pay the interest on the interest on the interest. And it never stops. And to keep paying off this debt, you have to use your oceans and your forests and your habitats to keep paying off the debt that's building, compounding in the borrowing of money. And I could go into more detail. I mean, when you buy a house, for example, for $100,000, you borrow money, the bank writes out of thin air, they have nothing in the vault, they're just writing out of thin air a check to you, here's $100,000 for your house. Now you have to pay us interest on that house. And by the time you get paying it off, you paid off a house that was $100,000 is now $300,000, right? Because of all the interest that's built up. So you had to work that many more hours, extract that much more raw materials to pay off the interest that you paid into that house. It's an exaggerated form of monetary exchange. And it's dangerous. In Minnesota, we just did a bonding bill, $1 billion. 3.6% interest on the bonds we'll sell. We have to pay interest on those bonds. By the time we get done paying it off, it'll be about $400 million of interest on that $1 billion. So to get that $400 million, you have to extract to pay off that interest. Keep extracting because you have to pay the interest on the debt. And this is on and on and on. And these financial sectors are out of control right now with derivatives and all sorts of games they play in the financial sector. So basically, if we had to pay off all the debt in the U.S. right now, we'd probably, you know, maybe on Earth, but generally in the U.S., we'd need multiple planets to pay off the debt. We can't afford it. So that, in a nutshell, is what we're dealing with. And I'm cutting a lot of corners in that
thank
discussion.
You.
Did that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Yes,
now, the genuine...
If we eliminated the privatization of that creation of money, and the people had their own bank and printed their own money, they wouldn't pay that interest. Would that solve
that's
that?
Correct. That's what a lot of people are talking about. How do you do that? And there's different versions and variations on that discussion. Printing money, having a bank, a public bank, you know, a lot of important discussions that I think need to be implemented quickly because it's just out of control. And it's driving this overshoot, this accelerated extraction on Earth. And so that's got to be remedied. And that's one of the things I work on as well. But it's not a primary focus. The genuine progress indicator is what I'd like to talk about today. And I will identify initially the gross domestic product right now is the primary economic signal that guides. So you'll see in the business section the other day, July 29th, growth keeps U.S. on recovery track. That's the top of the fold. And the gross domestic product is the indicator they're using. So this is today's world. No one's making it up. GDP is still the primary signal that's being used to tell us if we are not or not doing well as an economy. That's the premise of that headline, right? The GDP was invented back in the 1930s in the Depression era. At the time, the way we had measured the economy was the president would send somebody down to the railroad tracks, and they would, initially before that, they would count how many cars were coming in. You know, grain cars, coal cars. And that would be the guide for telling us how the economy was doing in the United States. But then President Roosevelt basically said, this is not working, we need a different measurement. And this gentleman named Simon Kuznets, who was an economist, came up with the gross domestic product. And basically it's data driven. You collect a bunch of data and you start developing a singular measurement called the GDP. And the GDP, and Simon Kuznets said it should not be used to be a guide for how the well-being of our economy, but it did get kind of co-opted into being used as a guide for the well-being of our economy. And the GDP is basically the primary signal. And what ended up happening was is there was a gathering in this place called Bretton Woods in 1944 eventually. And there was a gathering of all the allied nations. And they basically they developed the United Nations and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And they said the key measurement that's going to be used for any nation state joining the United Nations is the GDP. And there's the gross national product and the gross domestic product. I'm not going to go into the differences between the two. I'm just going to identify them as synonymous. And the GDP basically sets pricing, interest rates, and budgeting. If we go two negative quarters of GDP, it kicks in a recession. So it's a growth imperative as a measurement. If you don't grow, we go into recession. That's the message in the macro economy. And it is a macro measurement. It's different than other ways you would measure your economy on a local level, business, home, economy, and so on. The GDP does not recognize limits. It's a growth imperative, so it doesn't recognize limits, and it doesn't recognize value. It basically just shows activity in the economy, things moving around. That's the gist of it. And one of the things I'd like to play right now is a 2 minutes from Robert Kennedy, 1968, Kansas University. It was a 34-minute speech at Kansas University. This is 2 minutes out of it, which I consider 2 minutes powerful insights. But that you could see possibly why the gentleman, sadly, was shot, because he was so so viscerally honest about so much in that speech. But I'm just going to play you 2 minutes, and I do have the text of that. I'm not going to hand up. I've given you enough paper for now. So I'm just going to leave you with the paper you have. But I do have the text of this as if you want it. And I've got a lot of other handouts here. If you want other handouts that will supplement this discussion and fill in the blanks, I've got a lot of good stuff because I will not be able to cover all of this. The other thing is that if you want to keep in touch with the Ecology Democracy Network, we have people signed up all over the country. I've got a sign-up sheet here. So once again, I'm not going to be able to cover everything today, but just at least give you a sense of what we're doing. But to me, this is one of the more inspirational, what I call economic poetry, from Robert Kennedy. Hello. And I'm going to play that now.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community values in the mere accumulation of of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that, that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifles and Spex knives and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
You want me to play that again? Not at all. No, I mean, is it okay with everybody? You want to play that one more time?
Yeah.
Robert Kennedy, 1968, Kansas University, 4 months before he was killed.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community values in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that, that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifles and Spex knives and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, for the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
So back in the 1990s, there was a gathering of people at what's known as Redefining Progress. It was out on the West Coast, and they helped build on the work of Herman Daly and Cobb, they developed the Genuine Progress Indicator. And as soon as that was developed, a number of nation states around the world took notice, because they realized that the way we're measuring the economies, either at a nation-state level or on a global scale, is inaccurate, to say the least. And so the number of countries started looking at this. And the United States, in Minnesota, we had a sustainability roundtable, for example. And they came out with a report called Smart Signals in the late 90s. And in that report, they recommended Minnesota move away from using the gross state product or the gross domestic product as a primary signal to the Genuine Progress Indicator. And that inspired a number of other states in the country. And in 2010, Governor O'Malley, who was governor, very data-driven guy, he implemented the Genuine Progress Indicator at the level of the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources of Maryland. And following that, Vermont adopted it. from a more bottom-up approach. State of Washington adopted it, and Hawaii. All four states now have implemented it. I don't know how effectively they're using it at this point, but it is in their law, and they do have it available to them as a tool to measure their state's economy. And there are other states like Utah, Colorado, Ohio, who are on the brink of it. And here in Minnesota, we have a bill introduced. It's not as fundamental as I would like as a primary signal, but what we do is we have a bill that would offer an alternative spreadsheet to the GDP here in Minnesota. So when policymakers sit down, they would look at that. And what I'd like to do is I handed out this sheet. It's got the header, the Ecology Democracy Network header at the top. And on the other side is the Genuine Progress Indicator formula. You'll see this. It's generally known as the triple bottom line. Triple bottom line. Now, what I'd like to do is just differentiate, give some clear examples of the difference between the gross domestic product. Now, the gross domestic product is made up of about 52,000 indicators. It's a precise measurement. Don't want to lose it. But it should not be a primary measurement. It should be a back burner measurement. The GDP should be brought out when you need a footprint. And that's it. Outside of that, it should not be the signal that tells us if we have a good economy or not a good economy, as they keep saying in the newspaper all the time, and in the news in general. But I'd like to give some clear examples of the difference between the GDP and the Genuine Progress Indicator. Let's just take, for example, the Minnesota River watershed. Now, the Minnesota River watershed runs basically from the western part of Minnesota to the eastern part, and it eventually ends up going into the Mississippi River. In that last 80 years or so, the gross domestic product said, grow food for volume. And we did, very successfully, grew a lot of food. But there was no indicator in the measurement that said this groundwater cannot replenish itself. This topsoil cannot replenish itself. In the Genuine Progress Indicator, right around the mid-late 60s, it would have said, stop. This watershed cannot replenish itself. Groundwater, topsoil. So where the GDP did not recognize limits, the Genuine Progress Indicator does. Did that make sense? Okay, so that's one example of what I wanted to identify. Here.
There's more other people that came in.
Okay. Do you want, I'll just need a handout. Oh, here we go. So that's one example of. Of what I'm getting at. So, and we can talk and go into more depth about that activity. And I will. I'll go into more depth about that. That's from an ecological. So on that handout I just gave you that shows the formula for the GPI, the triple bottom line, this is the one I just handed to folks who just got it. This is what I'm looking at right now, is this particular handout. So we started with the environmental. That's the gist of that example. The other example I'd like to give is under the social, list there. So let's take, for example, a man or a woman. Now, women are generally doing about 60 to 80% of the world's work right now. More in the southern hemisphere of the earth than maybe the northern hemisphere, but women generally do most of the world's work right now. But, Ray, I'm just going to just take that out of the discussion at this point because that offers another pathway of a discussion under a gender balance that's essential on earth. But the gist is, man or a woman wakes up in Otter Tail County. Otter Tail County is about, 4 hours north of us here. Beautiful, gorgeous place. If you ever want to see a beautiful place, Otter Tail County, you guys. A lot of wetlands, a lot of frogs. I have been a mass killer, sadly, when I drove my car through frog migration once. I feel guilty to this day, and that was 20 years ago. But it's a gorgeous area, and they have beautiful creatures up there. But a man or a woman wakes up in Otter Tail County, 5:30 in the morning, takes care of the kids, it takes care of the animals, the kids, the cleaning, the cooking, the mending, till 9 at night for 40 years. In the GDP, that activity doesn't show up. That's invisible because no money has been exchanged. In the genuine progress indicator, you'd add a column into the spreadsheet that would value non-monetized activity. So all that work does not get recognized in the way we measure the economy right now. Now, we do patchwork. We do supplemental programs through governments, try to do patchwork on some in-home care or unpaid leave or whatever we try to do. But the gist is that it's not built into the macro impact of the economy. And so does that make sense, the difference between the two? GDP does not recognize non-monetized activity. Genuine progress indicator does. And that would be, as you can see here, under the social indicators, volunteer work, for example, does not get valued in the GDP. The genuine progress indicator does. And so that starts to create more balance in who's doing the work in society. Uh-huh.
I'm from Maryland, and that was one of the drawbacks that I noticed looking at O'Malley's PPI. Does not quantify things that he can't quantify.
Basically, how you would value that work is there's a couple of ways of doing this. One is, what would you pay somebody to do that same service in the home? So that's one way of quantifying it. What would be the market value for that work? And generally, people come up with a range from probably about $70,000 to $100,000 a year for somebody who manages a household. In that range, generally. I mean, I don't want to be exact, but And what it would do is it would basically offer a social pension of some kind. So there's a way of complementing that work, and it may not be exact. The other way to measure that is what are called opportunity costs. What would the skills of that person be in the marketplace, and what would they get paid for their work in the marketplace if they were able to go into the marketplace and do their work instead of having to staying at home? And taking care of a household.
And this $70,000 to $100,000 one, I suppose, looks at how many hours a day.
Cooking, cleaning, home maintenance, and sometimes a lot of in-home care for children, in-home care for elderly. That's not being valued by the GDP. Now, if you take an elderly person out of the home and put them in a nursing home, now it shows up in the GDP because money is being exchanged. Okay? Does that make sense? So that's one of the things, and once again, and I'm into equal pay for equal work. So I'm into that, I support that. But this is a whole nother sphere of imbalance that's created based upon mostly gender, because women are doing a lot of the in-home care at some level, maintenance, child care, elder care. Not absolutely, that is changing. So I don't want to say I know absolutely, but in general that is true.
But parents are.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct, exactly. The other line here, and the other line in the triple bottom line is economics. And one of the things I just wanted to recognize is that in the GDP, one person could gain all the benefits of productivity in Hennepin County, for example, which is we're in Hennepin County right now in Minnesota. One person could gain all the benefits of productivity and the GDP could improve. Because the GDP does not care about allocation. In the genuine progress indicator, and they're refining this, but the genuine progress indicator, they use what's known as the Gini coefficient. And when the economy becomes imbalanced, the measurement starts to shake. And it says, stop, stop, we're out of balance. So does that make sense, what I just described? So So I just wanted to clarify at least one example from each of these areas of these lines of indicators. Now, these are the 20, what you're looking at are 26 indicators that have basically been established by people who've been working on this GPI for many years. But regions can add their own indicators. Like Hawaii will add in an indicator on the health of coral reefs, for example. And also Australia. No doubt they're adding an indicator in frantically right now because the Great Barrier Reef is bleaching rapidly as we speak. And then, you know, other places like Nova Scotia where they did, there was a group called GPI Atlantic. I highly recommend it. I do have a handout from GPI Atlantic here. I'm not going to hand it to you now, but you can take it, come on up and take whatever you want. GPI Atlantic, which is a non-governmental organization, but they spent 20 years studying the GPI, and they have about 100 reports on their website. Highly recommend checking out some of these reports. But they identified that fisheries needed to be an indicator for their region because that was a big part of their economy. What's the health of the fisheries? And so on. So each region may tailor a bit to the genuine progress indicator based upon their needs in their region. Also, this has been refined. What we're trying to do is implement this at the state level because that's where you can get continuous funding. The nonprofits, the non-governmental organizations cannot afford to keep the data flowing. They just can't do it. I mean, some are doing it. Like, I mean, I work with people out of Portland State University in Portland, Oregon, and they're doing it, but they're like one of the few. But generally, if you can get states to do it, they can help fund it on a regular basis. That would be ideal. And then what we're looking at is that they're also learning how to tailor this to local regions. And so they're tailoring it to like Edmonton, Baltimore. So not at a state level, but now tailoring it down to more of a local level. I personally would like to see it tailored to a bioregion. I'm generally a bioregionalist in general. So the Great Lakes bioregion, or the Upper Mississippi Basin, or the Hudson Bay Basin, things like that. I would like to see a GPI pertaining to that region as well, those regions as well. So that's, in a nutshell, what I'm working on, is that this formula, in my opinion, helps maintain a semblance of balance, ecological, social, and economic balance. That helps allow for democratic systems to function in a healthier way. It's the imbalance that undermines democratic functions, in my opinion. So a disproportionate wealth going to too few people, and then that gets a smidgen of that is used to undermine us at the state capitals and so on and so forth. But ultimately, what I'd like to say is this. We're going to have to convene on a global level around changing the measurements because what goes around comes around. And the economy, normally I'm a person who says governance is a precursor to economies. We get together, we decide what kind of economy we want. But in the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, economy has transcended nation states at a variety for a variety of reasons, trade agreements, so on and so forth. And so we're going to have to convene at the United Nations eventually and rejigger some of these accounts that are being used on the planet. And the happiness index is an emerging measurement as well. The GPI is an emerging measurement. There's other few other examples out there that are emerging measurements. And we're just going to have to sit down as a planet and decide how, you know, do we measure. Now, just to give you an example, I can go on and on and on about examples. So, polluted water in the GDP is a credit on the spreadsheet, okay? Polluted water. Why? Because now you have to do remedial work. It's activity, right? You got to build up a pollution control agency and a DNR and a farming agency to manage that watershed, and it's showing up as a credit. You've got health effects. Immune deficiency, birth defects, deformities, cancer, death, all showing up as a credit on the spreadsheet of the GDP. because it's all activity. It's not valued in any way. In the genuine progress indicator, once you have to start doing remedial work in some way, it shows up as a cost, not a credit. That changes the measurement, which changes the pricing. So instead of seeing food as cheap, like we see now, cheap beef, for example, because we only see the price and not the cost, if we don't change that dynamic, if we don't internalize those costs into the price, there is no way we can sustain on Earth, period. There is no physical, mathematical way we are going to be sustaining on this planet. I don't care how many wind turbines you put up, how many solar panels, how many resilient communities you do. If the macro measurement for Earth says that contaminating water is a credit, we aren't going to protect water. In the GDP, yeah.
When you say counting contaminating water as a credit, I get a little mixed up in the sense that I see the contaminating water here, and then I see activity that's done to remediate that
right
over here, and this is what's counted. Not really the polluted water, but actually the effort to remedy that.
Yeah, once you've polluted the water, all the activity around it to do remedial work is showing up as a credit. Deepwater Horizon showed up as a credit on the planetary spreadsheet. Exxon Valdez showed up as a credit on the planetary spreadsheet because you got to hire lawyers, you got to do what they use the word clean, it's not really an accurate word, but they hire people to do cleanup.
So they're not recognizing that it's a
cost.
It's really a cost as a result of an accident. They're seeing it as activity.
Right, right, exactly. Give you another example, a forest. A forest in the GDP is only valued when it's cut and turned to product. Chipwood, lumber, whatever. In the genuine progress indicator, a forest is valuable in and of itself because it fixes carbon, fixes soil, filters water, filters air, habitat for birds. It offers what's known as an ecological service. So where the GDP does not recognize that, the genuine progress indicator does.
Excuse my ignorance, but how does the GPI show up? You mentioned the spreadsheet, you know.
Right.
So if this, for the states, for instance, that have a document, you know, is there like a guy at the Natural Resources Department or wherever, maybe the State Planning Department or wherever, that has a program that is actually a spreadsheet where these things are quantified and run through a program that gives them a number?
Yes. It's the objective is to come up with a singular number to replace the GDP. Vermont uses the most advanced spreadsheet right now in the country. So they gave Minnesota their spreadsheet, basically. Now, needless to say, there is no way we can quantify the aesthetic, the beauty, the love. There's so much that we can't quantify, and I wouldn't try to quantify it. So I'm not saying that everything can be measured and everything can be monetized. That is not the case. But the point is that if you do not value a forest for being a forest, then what you don't value will never be considered valuable unless you only value it for extraction. Now, this is, to me, obviously a deep concern, obviously, because I'm interested, my focus is reversing ecological overshoot and leading to a steady state economy. But this also creates imbalances in the way we measure. One of my concerns is the migration patterns of human beings on Earth. Okay? We've seen the last 100 years, like in Minnesota, 52 to 55% of the population in Minnesota. This deals with balance again. Balance. And which is linked to democracy. So we're tying all this into democracy based upon the word balance. And I can go, we can show examples of how this happened. But migration patterns on Earth, in Minnesota, for example, 52%, 55% were living in rural areas in 1940. That's down to 17% in Minnesota. And over the next 50 years, 80% of the population growth in Minnesota is going to go towards the metro. Because the way we measure the economy, we undervalue rural areas and we overvalue urban-suburban areas. So it creates a gravitational pull. So we're seeing like cities like Tokyo moving close to 40 million people. Shanghai, 25. Mexico City, 25 million. Lagos, 17 million. Los Angeles, over 10 million. The metro area we're in now, over 3 million. This is creating an incredible imbalance because we are centralizing human population in a way that creates a teetering effect for these central cities, and we are, in a way, creating a separation from the natural world, in a way, because people who depend, these central cities require so many external resources to exist, and it's like a vacuum on Earth right now. And a lot of people are completely unaware of what they're linked to and the consequences of their daily dependencies. And the way we measure the economy helps lend itself to that. Because if you don't value a watershed, forest, unless it's extraction, then people in rural areas are not being valued accurately. If you don't value, let's give you an example, energy. Minnesota sends about $18 billion a year out of the state to buy coal, oil, uranium, gas, and big hydro. We bring those fuels back into the state. Now, when we bring those fuels back into Minnesota, and I'm not even talking about the extraction process right now, but if you bring the fuels back in, all the agencies that have to manage those fuels, their activity around permitting and hearings and remedial work associated with oil or uranium and so on and so forth, all that activity is showing up as a credit on the state spreadsheet. Government activity is just a credit, just the activity going on. But in fact, in the genuine progress indicator, that fuel would be recognized, once you bring it into the state and you have to do all this remedial work and permitting and so on, would be considered a cost, not a credit. So that would then change the way we price the fuels. And it would become less attractive to send money out of the state to buy highly toxic fuels and bring them back in here. And we would start seeing more localization of that $18 billion in regions of the state that right now are flight of capital, where money's leaving to buy these fuels. So dollars would start coming back to rural Minnesota for efficiency and renewability, and a dollar that normally cycles maybe three times now cycles 7, 8, 9, 10 times in that local economy, stabilizing the population. Does that make sense? Okay. This is endemic with food. Same thing. Minnesota is no different than most regions of the country, about 1,500 miles to deliver a dinner to a dinner table. A lot of it's, we're externalizing a lot of the costs in food. Food production on Earth is the number one contributor to global warming right now. Number one, displacement of fixed carbon, heavy fuels, heavy fertilizers, heavy gases associated with the slurry ponds, all this stuff. Those costs are being pawned off on the future. They're not in the bottom line of that food. But once you start adding in the fertilizers, the pesticides, the herbicides, the displaced carbon, the long-distance transport, once you start adding that into a pound of beef or a gallon of milk or tomatoes or whatever, then it becomes less attractive to deliver food from 1,500 miles away. And it becomes more reasonable to deliver food from 400 or 500 miles away. That localizes and stabilizes economies. Does that make sense? So now we see less need for migration. Because we've seen on the planet Syria, drought was a precursor to a lot of the conflict we've seen there. South Sudan, drought was a precursor. The indicator didn't register the overuse of water in those regions. They all use the GDP as well. If you don't register it, you're going to see California, other places, we're seeing migration patterns change as well. But the gist is that these are ways, if you start measuring accurately, you can localize economies through the genuine progress indicator, stabilize population migration, and you can revitalize rural areas through localization in that respect. And I won't be able to go on and on and on as much as I'd like to about this. There's so many strains. And then you can stabilize these urban suburban areas because, like, for example, in the urban area, a car crash shows up as a credit on the GDP spreadsheet, right? Because you got to bring in an emergency vehicle, you got to tend to somebody in a hospital, you got insurance, you got rehabilitation, you know, that all shows up as activity. It's not valued. In the genuine progress indicator, a car crash would be considered a cost, not a credit. That gen changes the way we do land use planning, right? So it becomes less attractive to build an auto-centered transportation system, even though things are changing, but not rapidly enough, and the scale we need. But the gist is that changes the way we build our plan for our cities. Ultimately, when you start accurately measuring things, walkability becomes a natural outcome. Bicycles, trains, buses become a natural focus of planning, and that's far more. What happens then is that the cost of living starts coming down because it's less expensive to transport from point A to point B. Once the cost of living comes down, now people have more time in their lives for friends, family, social time, civic time, things like that, rather than just being producer consumers. Because what the GDP does is it rewards overproduction. And that's one of the areas I won't be able to get into, but overproduction in energy, food, land use, so on and so forth. Just to give an example of overproduction, garbage, when Coca-Cola doesn't want to deal with its bottles anymore and they externalize it onto counties, counties manage garbage, they have to, all this stuff in the GDP showing up as a credit, they have to have a committee hearing, they have to hire a truck, a driver, so on and so forth, all showing up as a credit on the GDP spreadsheet. And this ends up leading towards rationalizing, throwing things away. You see, our whole lives have been about throwing things away. And now that pile is growing and growing and growing on Earth. I mean, the largest human monument east of the Mississippi is the Fresh Kills Landfill on Long Island, right? We've got more tonnage of plastics in the ocean now than we have fish stock in the ocean. We have whole countries of plastic in the ocean. Out of sight, out of mind, but it still exists and it shows up in the bellies of our fellow creatures who allowed us to emerge on this earth to be here today in this physical form. This is how not only we're dealing with economics, but the ethics, the disgusting ethical behavior in relationship to our host is in and of itself a reason to adopt this, in my opinion. But just on accurate measurements alone is a reason to adopt this, okay? But in the genuine progress indicator, we're talking about garbage. Once that bottle from Coca-Cola leaves and goes to the county, in the genuine progress indicator, now it's a cost, not a credit to manage the garbage. Once you shift from a credit to a cost, then throwing things away becomes less attractive. Now the idea of durability, yes, I've had this 17 years, ugly, beaten up, still holds hot and cold, but this thing saves us 10 times in taxes every year as a durable product. Durability and repairability are far more effective way to measure an economy than disposability. And Once you have durability and repairability, not only does that lead to reducing the cost of living, because you don't have to purchase more and more extraction to make a product to throw it away after one or two uses, your costs are reduced that way, but also repairability leads to localism, because you need repair people on a local level to manage repairable products that are created in the manufacturing process. So durability and repairability are an outcome of the ecology or the genuine progress indicator. And one of the things I wanted to point out, I may have handed this to you. I handed this sheet to you. Now, this was put together by John Talbeth. John is one of the inventors of the, or one of the people who's managing the GPI in the United States right now and doing the cutting edge work on it. And you'll see this talks a lot about what we just discussed here today. The prevailing economy, GDP on the left, the new economy on the right. And much of what we discussed, you can see, translates from the old to the new. And that, to me, is really about, you know, what we're talking about. I talked about rural revitalization, so on and so forth. Durability, so on and so forth. It becomes an outcome of the genuine progress indicator. Restoration and revitalization of our habitats, economic balance becomes an outcome, things like that. So, any questions, thoughts? Yes.
I can see how using the genuine progress indicator will help those making social decisions, because they'll have a better perception of the actual cost and benefits.
Right.
But is there a way that that tool also will impact the actual price of something that, like food that you're buying?
That's what I'm working on. Ideally, that's the goal. I want whole cost accounting. I want true cost accounting, life cycle cost. You know, these are the realm of discussion. You're right. This needs to be, ideally, that's what I'm working towards, is making the GPI the primary economic signal. Right now, people are just using it as kind of a sidebar. It's not being used in a visceral way. But your point is well taken. We need to change the way we price things. A gallon of gas cannot be $2.30 a gallon anymore, because it's not an accurate price for that gallon of gas. The CO2 is not being measured in that gallon of gas, the emphysema, the bronchitis, the cancer. Now, I should mention, in Minnesota, the Public Utilities Commission just the other day added in for the first state in the country to add the social costs of carbon into a ton. I think they're using a ton of coal coming into Minnesota at this point, but also I think they're looking at gas and oil. But they are adding the social costs, so that will start to change pricing on fuels, because there are a number of things that go on with energy, for example, and there are many people think energy is the key point of indicator you need to focus on. But the idea of adding in whole costs to these fuels, to our food, to our transportation, that would shift the way we price things. So yes, that's a critical discussion. Critical. Thoughts?
What you say is it's very exciting for me. So I don't want to take much time, but I just want to say but part of me is kind of like, I'm wondering what are the forces in existence, what kinds of power in existence might be keeping this from being more widespread. Not necessarily. I mean, if we have the knowledge, how do we and we can incorporate the changes into the pricing system? What are the practicalities of getting to having this be more widespread?
That's a good question.
Things we're against.
Now, one of the things that, you know, once again, if you're in a rural area and you're seeing this gravitational pull over 80 years of your kids leaving and moving to the urban centers over and over again, you're desperate for any economy. They'll take any mining money. They'll take any logging money. They'll take any extraction money, factory farm money to just keep an economy going where they're desperate to keep an economy going, right? So there is a desperation almost in rural world, but I'm using Minnesota as an example. There's a desperation to have any economy because they feel this gravitational pull to the urban suburban centers, and they know that they're at a disadvantage, and they are. So they're accurately assessing it. But the thing is that powerful interests, you know, they'll dangle money in front of them and keep them in the game. So they can use populations in rural planet Earth or rural Minnesota as a leverage point to keep things the way they are. Most extractive industries on Earth want to keep things the way they are because they don't have to pay their external costs or all these pollutants and the CO2. They know that if they had to add it into the bottom line, many of these fossil fuel industries are out of business. They can't afford themselves. Uranium can't afford itself, right? Factory farms can't afford themselves, you know. So they know this. And that's why I've received some pushback. Now, I've met with over 200 members of the Minnesota House and Senate, Minnesota, the last few years, 200 city council members, mayors. I'm going to work on townships. I'm trying to really build a bottom-up movement with townships this year, to really make them realize that it's to their advantage to change the measurement. But generally, it's power. Hedge fund managers, they can sit in front of a computer all day and trade frantically. Each trade, they glean a little bit for themselves because the measurement rewards money over non-money. So they have gained a huge disproportionate advantage the last 40, 50 years, the financial sector, by using this measurement. Now, are they aware or not aware? I don't know. Are people wittingly or unwittingly taking advantage of this? I don't have time to figure that out. All I have time to do is start changing the measurement and talking to people on a regular basis about this. But the people that are really going to be against this are those that are gaming the measurement right now. And they feel they are godly because they figured this out. And it's dangerous. They're going to swallow up Earth, as we see. We're losing, and it's accelerating. It's not as if this is a steady problem. As you add 200,000 people to Earth a day, 7 million a month, 90 million a year, and you use this measurement, it adds to the acceleration effect of extraction and emissions. So it's not slowing. The only way it's going to slow is when we bump up against the biosphere. But even then, humans have learned how to adapt. We've learned how to accommodate. I mean, it's amazing how we can coexist with close to 8 billion people on Earth. And I keep telling the peace movement, your sure sign of success on this planet is that there's not a billion people. Because how do millions and millions of people peacefully coexist with each other? So there's something to be honored there. I don't want to take away from the goodness, all the love, all the caring that goes on every day. You want to value that. And that's part of what this effort is about, is valuing those things that are important to keeping society stable and strong. But we need to have societies that are in balance with the biosphere. Because if you undermine the biosphere, all subsystems are undermined, including us and our fellow creatures. And that's one of the things this effort is about, is to stabilize it. Because all the things that we've achieved in the sense of improving democracy the last 200 years, you know, ending slavery, women's right to vote, civil rights movement, Voting Rights Act, all are improvements on increasing participation in the system. Those are good examples of improving democracy. But those things that they overcame, if the ecosystem continues to be deteriorated, all subsystems feel the pressure of that. All the things achieved all the things that were overcome start to reemerge. What I would call cultural atavisms, or things that we thought we grew over, come back again. and we're starting to see the breakdown of breakdown nations. Now, there's a lot of parsing that can go on at this point, but the gist is that this measurement, the genuine progress indicator, starts to bring us into balance, and we start to recognize that there's value in things that are not being valued right now. So I want to thank you. I don't know. Yes, please. Questions.
As an educator, I would like to mention that each of us here probably could go out and go to their own local library and offer a little talk.
Mm-hmm.
About, don't call it a seminar or anything like that. Just call a little talk about how much things cost. I don't know. You could frame it whatever.
Right.
The
difference between the price and the cost.
Yeah. And the ecological balance and these, the environmental services that are not being valued and that kind of thing. I think each of us could do that, or else, or also go to your local high school and talk to the social studies teachers, the environmental, teachers and biology teachers, whatever, and ask them if they, are able to include topics like this in their curriculum.
Right.
There are curriculum standards that have to be met, and I'm not sure of exactly where they stand right now. But, even the mathematics teachers should be happy to use examples
right.
like this of real life that's in the community. Kids can go out. I'm a former high school teacher. So you get the kids to go out and find out this data, and then you manipulate it, you organize it, and you see and let these patterns emerge.
Love it.
I think it'll be powerful.
Love it.
But each of us, I'm concerned because I'm getting older. I'm not in a classroom anymore. And so, what can I do right now? I think I could probably run a series of little talks in our local library. We have a small community.
Right, and I do have the Minnesota bill here if anyone wants to take one. What's that? Representative Schultz, she's out of Duluth. She's got the most beautiful district in the state, right on Lake Superior. But she's a healthcare economist professor at the University of Duluth. And so I basically had a 15-second discussion with her, and she grabbed it and says, "Yeah, okay, thanks." And that was pretty much it. I didn't talk to her pretty much after that. Next thing I know, she drafts a bill on this. It was like I had longer discussions with people who totally disagreed with me, much longer, who just liked to banter. And then Senator Marty out of Roseville, he's the author in the Senate. And he's really into this now. I think he's getting this. So we've got people, they understand the value. This is, like I said, Minnesota was ready to do this. I'm just dusting off old work. This is like old work. Tim mentioned he worked on this many years ago. Well, so this is like, it's like, why are we still having to do this?
ran into this with our light rail project. The north, the Botno one, they made a decision to just railroad through in the shortest amount of time a plan for where the light rail will go. It just happens to go exactly where the railroad tracks, the old railroad tracks, and we're all sitting there going, who's going to get the money for this? Oh, yeah, let's see, the railroad. Okay, so it comes through now, three parks, and Theodoreth Park, one of the most beautiful in the region, has a lot of wetlands. Where does the path go? Right through the wetlands. And they're going to dig it up. And you know what they're going to do? They're going to put wetlands somewhere else. Same number of acres somewhere else. And I've asked so many young people. I go to the state fair, I go on the young people running the stuff, the biological stuff at the state fair. They say you can't do wetlands like that.
That's
the
right.
Soils, you would have restructure, you'd have to replace all the layers of soil and all the microorganisms that are in there.
Thousands of years.
And the drainage. Mm-hmm. And
right.
Yep, can't be done.
Yeah.
And if you go against it,
you are against the unions because there's going to be so many jobs associated with building the light rail. God, I'm not against jobs. I think unions are great. But
so why do they want to put it through the park? Because that's less expensive than putting it.
Well, they say
other people's property.
They say it's going to be less expensive because there's not so much stuff to knock out of the way.
Right.
However, it goes where there are not riders.
Right, and they're not valuing, as Ken would has explained, they're not including the value of that parkland.
That's right.
And I just finally gave up.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
What stage is it at?
Well, now it's kind of stalled because our legislature is not funding light rail, and the money, and other people are terrified because the federal money's going to run out, and, you know, there's no clarity anyway, any place. The place it should have gone is down along Highway 100 from Robbinsdale, crossed over the top, and gone right down to the city. But they omitted that track. That was one of the choices. They say, if you ask why that one got omitted, it's because it's too expensive. We were fixing the GDP, right?
Right. And I mean, automobiles are egregiously expensive, but because it shows volume and it shows activity, it shows up as a credit on the GDP spreadsheet. So you can put one person. Basically, Minnesota has 1.1 person per automobile in the state. So you put a 150-pound person in a 3,000-pound vehicle and transport them in a sprawling region, and it all shows up as a credit on the spreadsheet, even though it's a huge cost and a huge waste of planning at so many levels. So the measurements are inaccurate in transportation. And I did want to just identify one of the points that I wanted to make real clear. There are two political parties generally in the country, but I'm into a multi-party proportional system. That's what I would like, and we have plans for that. But the gist is this. One party says they want less government, less taxes, less regulation. The other party says they want sustainability. So here's just, I'm going to hold this up. I have extras. But Vermont, right here. So the solid line is the GDP. The checkered line is the genuine progress indicator. Right about 1968, they diverge, okay? They diverge, okay? That is the point you have to decide. Do you want less government, less taxes, less regulation? And do you want sustainability? Because once you go beyond the point of that watershed being overused, you can't get less of anything, and you can't have sustainability. So both groups have to decide. If they really want less of something and they really want sustainability, then you better start changing the way you measure the economy. Because the way we're measuring now, you'll never achieve sustainability and you'll never achieve less of anything. Because the dominant measurement says grow, 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 or you go into austerity. And austerity basically is code for giving from those that have the least to those that have the most on earth. And that's the gist of a lot of this discussion. So this is not a partisan issue. This is about accuracy. And the way you measure an economy leads to incentives. Incentives leads to behavior. What happens to people psychologically when they see 2-for-1? They go, wow, what a deal. What do they say when they see 30% off? Wow, what a deal, right? What do they say when they say, oh, gas is below $2 a gallon? Wow, what a deal, right? So if people don't think pricing does not create incentive, they're deceiving themselves. And there is no way. It's like climbing a greasy rope. We're trying to get sustainability. We're trying to get to democracy. We're trying to get the balance. But the rope is so greasy, we'll just keep holding, but it's not going to get us to where we need to go. And that's the way this economy is working right now, like a greasy rope. We're trying to get there, And we've done some amazing things, and I don't want to take away from the goodness. I don't want to take away from the love. I don't want to take away from the aspirations and the inspiration from so many people that I have learned from. I am so grateful to be here today. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing this, because I love the place I live. I love where I live. I've grown up in such bounty and such beauty here in Minnesota. And we live on such a beautiful and bountiful planet that seeing it decimated and contaminated and seeing our fellow creatures that allowed us to emerge being treated in such disgusting and inhumane ways and being wiped out to extinction is an unacceptable act based upon premeditated awareness. We are fully aware of what we're doing, and yet we can't seem to stop. The momentum is growing, and I understand why the momentum is growing. But now we're aware, and people are attempting on Earth to rectify the condition, and that's what the GPI is about. It's an attempt to buffer a collapse that's inevitable at this point.
Thank you.
I got a sign-up sheet if you want it. Extra handouts to supplement the discussion. Take whatever you like.